I was told this is a rather informal seminar, so I guess that everyone should just ask questions when it's appropriate. So I'm going to talk about work that we have done in recent years, or recent few years, on trying to optimize reaction coordinates, and at the same time say something about kinetics and free energy. And we do all that using path sampling techniques. So I have a brief outline of the seminar. I'll start with an introduction of what the framework of the approach is. Then I give some explanation of what path sampling is for the people that don't know it, how we compute rates, how we do reaction coordinate analysis. And if I have time, I am going to show you an application to crystal nucleation in colloidal systems. But if there's no time, then we skip that. So that's maybe for another talk. And I end with conclusions. So we have seen this before. We're interested in describing complex systems. And when you have complex systems, you often have a hierarchical landscape where you have stable states or metastable states where the trajectory, a microscopic trajectory, dwells for a significant time. So on a microscopic level, you could do a molecular dynamics simulation or any Langevin simulation or something which is microscopic. And this will typically, in a complex system, looks like this. It will stay for a while in one state, then hop to another state, dwells there for a time, etc., etc. And usually we make a Markov approximation where we say, well, the memory in this state is actually lost, so we can actually view every hopping event individually. So the point is, of course, that there is a separation of time scales here. So we have to assume that the microscopic time scale is much faster than the macroscopic hopping time scale. So here we actually are thinking of femtoseconds for the time step. And if we move to the coarse grain trajectory, we think of this Markovian state model where we have these metastable states defined. And then we have these rate constants between these states. I just pointed here a few. Of course, there's a whole matrix. And the master equation describes the probability for finding yourself in one of those states as a function of time. So solving this you can do with analytically, of course, but also if it's very complex, you can actually use a kinetic Monte Carlo. Now the input to go from here to there is a coarse graining problem where you need to evaluate what the rate constants are for each process in the Markov state model. So that's the background, and actually it also relates very much to what people have been saying about Morris-Swanzig type of problems and also about coarse graining in general. Okay, so now comes the point of what happens if you try to calculate a reaction rate using now a simplistic two-state model. So now we actually are this is complex. So we first look at one particular transition. Now the point is, if people try to calculate rates, they usually do this by calculating first the free energy barrier as a function of a order parameter or collected variable reaction coordinate. And this is the top title statement, that a biased sampling usually requires a reasonable reaction coordinate or a reasonable collective variable. And examples are umbrella sampling, metadynamics, all kinds of biased non-Boltzmann sampling. And the objectives of these type of samplings is that they want to obtain free energy barriers and, if possible, rates, but also transition states and the mechanism, the underlying mechanism that takes place. Now, if you have a wrong idea of your reaction coordinate, then all of this actually might turn out wrong.
Does it mean that you actually give you the wrong answer, or is this inefficient?
I think it actually means it's actually wrong in qualitatively wrong. That, I mean, and I try to show this with this picture. So suppose this is your, and this is actually an old picture that, for example, Dave Chandler always draws up. So I mean, if it looks familiar, then you should actually remember that. So this is a two-state problem where you have an order parameter in this direction and possibly other coordinates that you don't care about in another direction. So you have two stable states and a settled point. Now, this is, of course, a very simplistic situation where this particular reaction coordinate describes the whole process. And if you use your standard statistical mechanics, then you can actually devise a free energy profile, which actually has a single barrier, which is located right at the settle point. And that means this is an almost perfect description of the process. Now, if this looks like this, where something first has to happen in an orthogonal degree of freedom, which you didn't think about, then the settle point might be here, located. But if you use your projection, you still find this particular transition state. And this is not unlikely. I mean, this happens all the time in a complex system. So what this means is that if you're sitting on top of this barrier using this coordinate, you're actually already committed to a stable state, which is not the settle point. I mean, we were interested in this point, not in that point. And an example, I mean, this is an old example where I did a very quick umbrella sampling simulation. So, I mean, this is not state of the art, obviously, but if you have a simple peptide folding, unfolding reaction, and you use RG as a coordinate. Now, we all know the radius of gyration is terrible as a coordinate, but this is just to show this. So if you start with a folded state, you unfold it by increasing the radius of gyration, and then try to refold it using the radius of gyration, using umbrella sampling. Well, clearly, this doesn't work. I mean, you have an enormous amount of hysteresis, and this is precisely because that you actually end up in a different valley or in different minimum. And this is precisely because, I mean, it's even worse. I mean, this means that if you go this way, you go over this barrier, and if you go that way, you end up somewhere completely different. So
I'm just having trouble seeing why that height, the maximum of the free energy from the picture through the top, why that should be like a bottleneck.
This one?
Yeah. Well, why would, from looking at the top picture, why would you expect the
bottleneck is here.
Yeah, but then why is the free energy maximum?
Well, that's because you have to do this projection. So the most of the weight of this along this part will be over here. So this will be low, whereas most of the weight is here, which is high. So you still have it will be lower. So this is not completely. If these barriers are the same, this should be actually a little bit lower. But it still has the maximum here. You can try it yourself if you want to do it.
You integrate it down.
It's integrating out. It's the Boltzmann factor which actually.
If you integrate it out, you would not make a mistake. It's because you're not able to do that efficiently.
No. I did integrate this out. No. This is the actual integration. You can do it in your Mathematica. You get this. It's because this has the highest weight. So this will be low. And over here, it is actually over the whole thing. This is the highest weight here. It's still lower than over there, but it still is the highest point on the barrier.
What he's referring to is at the end, you will get to the right state, but your energy barrier is much higher. So what you from that projection is an energy, a free energy barrier, which is by far too high, rather than going through the curve linear coordinates, by going through the.
Okay, so this is a very good point. I mean, this is actually too low. So the barrier, every coordinate that is not the true coordinate gives a lower barrier. I mean, you should actually realize that. The highest barrier is the most correct barrier. And that is because the transitions.
So when you say the word projection, you mean.
I mean this. Yeah.
Okay, so then I agree with you, but that's. I think maybe that's slightly confusing terminology.
But this is what I would call the projection from the Q prime state. The space to the Q space.
Yeah, but if you just saw that as a landscape and you look at it from the side,
yes,
you, it's strictly a projection.
Well, you will see this.
Well, no, you wouldn't see that.
No, you will see this.
You can't.
Okay, we can discuss this.
A strict geometrical projection is finding the envelope of something.
It's not a geometrical projection, it's a Boltzmann projection.
Well, okay, so that's
the point. So it's the Boltzmann projection which actually weights according to the lowest value in this landscape has the highest weight, and that dominates.
And the idea is that if you're doing umbrella sampling on Q, this is what you
would... If you do perfect umbrella sampling, you get this value, this curve. But you still, you're not sampling this region where you possibly, which you possibly want to sample, because this would be the dynamical bottleneck where you're interested. I mean, this is the what chemists call the transition state. So yeah, so maybe if we continue, this becomes more clear. But I mean, I realize that this is always a little bit of a problem. But it really is true that if we are trying to get a transition state, a true transition state, to come back to what a true transition state is, it will often fall in a minimum of the free energy. So if I have a pre-free energy projection, my transition state might fall here. This is true, and actually you see it very often. And you might say, okay, well, what's the point? But if you're interested in a mechanism by which you say, okay, this is a mechanism through which something happened, I mean, it makes a difference whether or not you sit here or there. Okay, maybe we continue.
Peter, I'm not sure what's going on here in this picture, because free energy as a function of virus duration is, of course, well defined. So this is a sampling problem.
This is indeed a sampling problem. I actually condensed these two. I mean, there is a slight missing which says that if you do umbrella sampling, then you actually end up with hysteresis if your thing is not right. So in umbrella sampling, if you go one way and the other way, you end up with hysteresis. Yes. Yeah. And this is the same as, I mean, you will see that here. If you do it this way, you will go via a different path than if you go that way. That's the hysteresis. And that's what you see here. And I mean, if there was perfect sampling, this would be converging. It doesn't. Okay, so the idea is, this was a long introduction, and the idea is that we don't want to know a priori about the reaction. We want to actually give it, extract it from the simulation rather than input it in the simulation. So we use a transition path sampling. And just to give you a reminder of what this is, so it's the important sampling of the rare event path ensemble. And the path ensemble is the collection of all dynamical trajectories that go over a high barrier. And this is supposed to indicate that. So this is our high dimensional landscape here. This is a potential energy landscape. And well, it's only two dimensional, of course, but think of it as a many dimensional. So we have a stable minimum here and another stable minimum here. And then we have trajectories which leads over this, well, large barrier in between. And you can already see that are many different possibilities. Now, why would we do this and not do umbrella sampling or metadynamics or something? Because we want to have unbiased rare paths. We really want to have an unbiased dynamics. So we don't want to impose the coordinate. We want to extract it. And indeed, we can actually use what I'm going to explain, committer analysis, to extract it. And we can get rate constants which are independent of the reaction coordinate. So this is this is the reason why we do it. The way we do it is by constructing an ensemble, a path ensemble, and it's given by this formula here. And it actually is the dynamical path probability of a path X, where X is a multidimensional vector consisting of the whole system, all particle positions and momenta, and the L stands for the time duration, the length of this path. Yeah, so it's a function of the time. So this is actually a pretty complex object. It's not only the actual state, but it's the state as a function of time. But you can write this down. And for example, for a Newtonian trajectory, it's just the product of delta functions, yeah, because each state is following from the previous state as a delta function. So this is just a product of delta function. Only if you really obey the Newtonian trajectory, this actually gives an entry.
Now, so how does the initial condition come into play?
Yes, the initial condition, I realize now that I completely skipped over the initial condition slide. This particular these here, has a initial condition as a function of the coordinates and the momenta. So this could be, for example, the Boltzmann distribution, which is the steady state distribution. Alternatively, you could think of a non-steady state or non-Boltzmann distribution as an initial condition, for example, in non-equilibrium. For the moment, we actually look at
which well you might be in. I mean, how do you?
Yeah. So I mean, this could be the start of the trajectory, and this the end. So this the point here would be the initial condition. Yeah. I should have brought the slide with the initial conditions. I'm sorry about this. I skip over this because I thought everyone was familiar with this, but maybe not. So then you have two functions which actually restrict the path to start in one state and end in another state. And this is, of course, the whole trick, as we call it. This is the bias, the constraint that you put on the path. So you only select those paths that start in A and end in B. So this function says it only gives a contribution if I am in A, and this one only when I'm in B. And so this is a indicator function, and it's just a discrete function. It's either 0 or 1, and it selects the path out of all possible pathways.
So should we think of the numerator as like a functional integral over all paths?
Yeah, this is actually like a partition function. Maybe I'm actually putting it. No, so this is this is like a summary slide.
Sure.
So this is the indicator function. So if you are an A, then you have an entry here, and if you're not an A, then if you're 0. So all the information about the system has to be in this function. So if I have to put some stable state information inside this function. So that's this is actually where we now put all the physics, so to speak. So previously we would have a reaction coordinate which brings us from one state to the other. Now we have these two functions which bring us from one state to the other. This is of course just given. This is just the Newtonian dynamics or the Lagrangian dynamics. And now the trick is what we now do. We sample this ensemble, so this is like a distribution, and this distribution can be sampled using Metropolis, for example. You can also sample it by other means, but Metropolis is the easiest. And what we do then, we create a trial trajectory, and this is just a generic way of showing that this is a trial trajectory. And if this trial trajectory is still part of this distribution, you can actually accept or reject it using this Metropolis scheme. Now, this is very generic. Yes?
How do you pick the L for this, right? I mean, that's sort of the defining your ensemble of paths.
Yes, okay. So there are several, that's a very good question. L is a variable. There's various instances of the methods where you can either keep a fixed value or you can do a variable, fixed length or a variable length. And in what I'm going to show, we always use variable length. And the reason that it's more efficient and it doesn't require you to set the length in advance. Now, what is then the L? The L is just the time that is needed to exit A and enter B. So it's completely determined by this by the system parameters. So there's no choice.
You could let L be a stopping time, is that what you're saying?
Basically, L is the stopping time, yes. So if I would start here, and I continue my dynamics until I hit this, that would be the length of the parameter.
What's happened if the trajectory never reach the region?
Then L goes to infinity.
Yeah, and you're just
continuing. Yes, there is, of course, so that is true. And that means that in practice, you need to have a upper limit. In principle, however, this will never happen. Because if I have a two-state system and it's ergodic, I will always go to one of the states. I can, of course, I can also return to this state, and that's of course a rejection. This is not part of this state. So you either go to this state or to that state, and that's the end of it. Oh, I realize now that I should have gone through the entire introduction on path sampling. This was just a summary slide. This was just for reminding you about how it works. So if anyone wants to know more, then I can actually tell them about afterwards. But this has been around for like 15 years now. So I think that people can look in the literature. So I want to go on. There is this flexible shooting algorithm. So that means that that the length actually changes, and then you have to put these lengths inside the Troplus scheme, but that's just a detail. Okay, so how does it work? So, I mean, this is also, again, a bit of a summary slide. So we have an initial trajectory, and now, before you ask how do you get this initial trajectory, this is given. So suppose that we have a given initial trajectory, and then we select a random point on this trajectory, and this is this red dot here, which is just one state point, one coordinate and velocity. We change the velocities a little bit, and then we create a new path, which actually is different. Now, this is actually the Metropolis move, and it's a bit like a hybrid MD, yeah? A bit like a hybrid MD move, where you just change here the momenta, so you don't touch the positions, but still, because of molecular chaos, you will get a different trajectory, which actually diverges from this initial trajectory because we are on the barrier. Of course, if we were on the not on the barrier, then things would converge in rather than diverge. So it's the trick lies in the fact that we are on the barrier, and we know we are on the barrier because we exit here and we enter there, and there we stop. So it is very delicate to actually find these states, but not as delicate as finding the barrier itself. Okay, now then, of course, this is the first step, and then you extract or reject, and then you do a new one, and you can see that this one is now completely different from, and has in two steps there is complete decorrelation, and that's because this Monte Carlo move is very non-local. Now you do a non-local move in phase space.
So when you think of a more complicated molecular system, don't you run into the problem that you kind of are stuck in local minima?
That's a very good question. Of course, if there are local minima which are long-lived, then this will actually create traps. But the assumption here is that we actually only look at a two-state system, and there are no minima. Of course, if there are minima which are long-lived, then you have to take them into account, and we actually come to that later. I mean, this is like an idealized system that has only two states and no further minima.
You said that you start from the barrier. Do you have to be really on the barrier on any point of the path before you?
Random point is actually uniformly distributed, so we don't have any information on where to. Of course, I mean, if you're here. If you start here, the chance of rejection is much higher than if you start here in the middle. The best acceptance ratio will be here. So here it's only almost 100%, whereas here it's almost zero. So on average it's like 50%. So I mean 50%, 30%, that's all right. There are other schemes, and I come to that later, where we actually can go to a rejection-free method. That's enough for now. So, I mean, this is actually an interesting point because we are using Metropolis here, we can use all the machinery that has been developed for Monte Carlo, including all kinds of biasing moves, all kinds of, collective moves or whatever, you know, I mean, tricks that actually accelerate the sampling. That's the idea. Okay, I want to go on. So we actually compute the rates. I mean, one thing is that this does, of course, gives us a collection of pathways between two states. But the what you don't get is the rate constant itself, because the rate constant itself actually needs something else, and that is given here. So maybe I should actually first look at this scheme. Let's go. So we do this by what's called transition interface sampling. And the interface sampling is slightly different from the path sampling in that we now use so we designate all the states on the trajectory a certain color, a certain state, it's called an overall state, based on where it came from. And this is if it did came from A, so all these the whole trajectory is colored red, and if it actually enters B, then it becomes blue, and then this one becomes blue, and then when it enters A, it becomes red. Now, why do we do that? Because then the whether or not you actually belong to A or B doesn't depend on spontaneous excursions between A and B, or just if you exit A and you enter very shortly afterwards, this is not counted as a true transition. So only if you go from A, you enter B, then it's a true transition. So immediately, this also points out that you assume that when you hit B, that you are truly committed to B, and you will not return immediately. So that's a very an important point that is a constraint on the definition of B. Now, what can we do with that? We can make a time correlation function of the probability that you are in A in the beginning and in B at the time t. So this is a function of t, and we can do an ensemble average of that. And this is a slowly increasing function. Of course, it starts at zero and then it actually continues up linearly. And the derivative of this in out of statistical mechanics gives you the flux coming in through B, provided that you actually started in A. And this is known as the rate constant, because it's just the number of AB trajectories divided by the dwell time in A. And that's actually the rate. So this is what we try to calculate. Of course, this is a very low number. I mean, if you have a true rate, this this usually is orders of magnitude lower than the microscopic. It's usually a very low number. Let's say that a very low probability. And
no, is that supposed to be xt? And just go. Is that xt in the second part dot hbxt?
Oh yeah, no. This is a good point.
What do you evaluate the initial?
There's a okay. So this is the original time dependent point, but we can actually, because of this these definition, we can actually show that the only contribution to this will happen when we are entering B.
Yes.
And we can take this as a zero point. So we shift the time such that this is the T0 point. I don't want to go into too much detail. This is a technical point, and it's really, it's a shift of time frame, and it has no physical meaning. It's just a trick.
But the X naught in the left and the right, I shouldn't think of it as being the same value, is what you're saying.
I made a time shift from here to there. So there's a few lines of derivation in between.
Capital X zero, capital Y zero, or something. Okay.
Yeah. So I
two different random numbers. Right? One of these.
These are not random numbers. It's just a time shift here. So we actually do.
In the K, that expression there, the question is whether the two X zeros are actually the same.
Yeah. Precise.
And they appear to be at the same time, which looks a bit surprising. The question may have X minus T.
I see the points. Maybe this should be. I see the point. Maybe this should be minus. This should be minus t probably. This could be. Okay, so I should. I just focused on this.
That's fine. The rate constant depends on t. Is that what you?
No. That's the whole point. So I mean, okay. So there's a whole. The whole theory means that we actually have a plateau value. And usually the plateau value. So this would be a normal CT function. And if we take the derivative, this would be a, let me see. It actually goes to a plateau value. And I think it goes like this or something like that.
Yeah, okay.
So this is then, and then after a while, you have this exponential. So here's a time scale difference. This is so this is the molecular time scale. And this is the reaction time scale, or relaxation time scale. So this is actually the separation of time scale that we're looking at. And we're only interested in this plateau value, which is actually what we call KAB, which is the rate constant. So, and this particular formula is true for this particular plateau value. So it's not a time-dependent value anymore. And I have to admit that it seems a bit strange that this is actually happening at t0, But the I'm not so sure about this particular time. But what we do is we evaluate this flux through here, which means it's actually time independent. Okay, I hope that's not too confusing. Okay, so now maybe it becomes clear in this picture. Because I told you it was a very low probability, that what we actually want is this particular object. So we want to have a probability that if we leave A, so we actually enter B after a time, after a time. So that's given by this probability, and this is actually now a more generalized probability where we make a foliation of all of hyperplanes. So this is the hyperplane around B, and we actually make this whole foliation until it actually goes to B to A. And these are indicated by these lambdas, which act as interfaces or milestones. I mean, in certain terminologies, the point is that they are non-intersecting. Now, then you can actually define these probabilities, saying that if I leave A, which is this subscript, I cross lambda I, for example, this here, so this would be this one, and then I either continue or I go back to A. So this would be an excursion which didn't make it to B, but I can still ask the probability to get to the next interface, next milestone. And then you can actually show that this particular object that we are wanted is the object to this is the flux from A to B provided by divided by the dwell time, that's equal to the flux coming out of A, which is of course a very high number, divided by the dwell time, which you also easily get, times this probability object, which actually says if I leave A, what is the chance to go to B, and that can be divided into a product of sub probabilities like this. So this is like a staged approach where you go from one interface to the other. So at each interface here, you calculate the probability to go to the next interface based on these trajectories. So you have here a one trajectory crossing this lambda, and this one is rejected, for example, because it doesn't cross. This one is accepted. And this one is also accepted. And here you can see it crosses the next interface. So you can actually construct this whole product there. And of course, you also need this first flux, which is very simple from MD. Now, this is known as transition interface sampling. And it, for the people that are interested in rare events, this is exactly the same as the forward flux approach, where the forward flux has exactly the same approach, except they don't. They don't do Monte Carlo sampling, but they just add paths to the existing ensemble of paths. But it's not an important sampling. Okay, so this is actually how you construct these probabilities. And now, of course, the problem lies into how to efficiently distribute your interfaces and how to efficiently sample the pathways with Monte Carlo. Now, you need a couple of tricks for doing that. So you need flexible shooting, the time reversal moves, interface replica exchange moves. You can improve your sampling by including paths that actually sample the stable states. So these are all tricks to actually enhance the sampling. But it does work very nicely. So here's
an. Ask a question. To what extent in that picture is lambda not a reaction coordinate?
Aha! No, this is a very good point, because I was asking for that question. Yes, what we actually now are doing is, of course, reintroducing a collective variable, and so you might say, why don't I do just umbrella sampling or metadynamics on this particular landscape using this as a parameter. Now, the answer is that this is not necessarily a good reaction coordinate. In fact, it could be as bad as the Q that I was showing in the beginning. The only the saving grace is that you can actually construct these unbiased trajectories, and by reconstructing the entire path ensemble, you get still unbiased directives.
So if you make a poor choice of lambda, things will be slow to converge, etc., but you won't actually converge on the wrong answer.
So here, exactly. That's a good point that should be made. You will always end up with the true trajectories. It's only a matter of waiting. Sometimes you have to wait longer than another. So the idea is then, and then maybe that's running ahead, is to use these pathways that you create to construct a better coordinate, which you then can use to sample in a better way. So it's like an iterative scheme, so to speak. But for the moment, we assume that this is actually, it's there. It could be a simple coordinate, and that gives you the entire answer to the kinetics. That this works can actually is shown for trip case folding a couple of years ago. I don't want to go too much into detail here. So this is the unfolding rate here, and this is the folding rate, so you can get reasonable answers, which actually also correspond to experiments. So coming back to the question of what happens if you have multiple states, or if you have intermediate states that actually are acting as traps, we can easily extend this whole framework to having multiple states, and then we actually envision this like this. So we have these states, we have these interfaces around them, but now they are not a foliation anymore, and they can actually intersect as long as you make sure that each interface belongs to its states that it's connected to, and then you can construct a flux out of the state plus the probability matrix to go to the other states, and that gives you a complete rate matrix. I had a little example on the alanine dipeptide that everyone does. So here we have six states. It's clear that these states are very... So this is the sci-fi map, the Ramachandran plot. So we have these... I think it's the... I always forget. It's the beta sheet state and the alpha helix state. And then you can see that there is there must be a quick exchange between these A, B, and these C, D points. So we actually put them together in one state, and then we can actually compute the entire rate matrix using this scheme. And this works very well with straightforward, compares very well with straightforward calculations. I don't want to put too much into that in view of the time.
So with that technique, I mean, can you see whether you're really getting an exponential as a good fit to the transition time, or whether you get a deviation with another type of distribution? Like you're computing rates, but can you use a similar sampling technique to get the full distribution?
Okay, so the assumption is that we do have this plateau value. Yes. So in principle, you always have an exponential.
But would your method let you diagnose situations where you don't? You could imagine where you have a diffusion limited transition or something instead of being a jump over an energy barrier.
Yeah, well, the whole method relies on the fact that you are relaxing, you quickly relax to one of the states. So if it's diffusion limited, this might actually be a problem. So I mean, this is not a good method for diffusion.
So you had like an energy barrier and then flat for a while and then came down.
Yeah, that could work. That's not a problem. But I mean, you have to be able to really commit yourself to one of the states. That is something that goes into the model. I mean, it's not a generic model as saying that we can use it for anything. So there are some constraints on the method. So one of them is this separation of time scales. That's where you always start.
Since you've done some calculations for proteins, do you have a sense how well it works? Because I mean, in proteins, there are lots of barriers which are just a few kT, right? So there's no very good distinction between states in that case.
In this case, there was a good distinction, and we could calculate it. But in general, yeah, you're right. I mean, this might be. I mean, I'm not saying that we solved everything. Of course, it's just trying to.
No, but I mean, could be that's not really a problem at the end of the day. Maybe it's not. You know, it's the last thing to worry about. That given that your force field is lousy.
That is true. But I mean, you want to have a method that is both efficient and accurate to compute rates between protein stable states. I mean, and by stable states, I mean, that's a whole different discussion. What is a stable state? And maybe we can actually do that at the end. But provided that we have a description of these stable states, this type of methods can actually compute the rate matrix for that. And this should be corresponds to the transition matrix itself. And then, of course, you, if you can do that, then you have a an exponential time series. Okay, more questions about that?
Dipeptide is not quite a protein yet.
No.
So what is sort of the largest system that you can handle? I mean, by these multi-minima proteins.
So we're now working on. Okay, so I showed you these. This small. This is also a small protein, the tripcase. But now we're trying to put it on a signaling protein, which is slightly larger, which is 120 amino acids. But that's already quite complex.
So how many minima do you handle there? Just sort of get a feeling for
the. So we do have a reaction network which consists of, I think, of 6 or 7 minima.
And then you lump any conformational states into one single minimum, or how do you do it?
Well, of course, I mean, that's the whole point. I mean, one conformation is not a stable state. A stable state is a collection of minima, which all interconvert very quickly. So there is a time scale connected to this interconversion, which is much faster than the jumps between these states. I mean, this has. Yeah.
So how do you actually find the basis of the field that you're talking about?
Yeah, this is, of course, a completely different project, which completely different question, which I completely left out of the picture. I mean, that's what I said in the beginning. We moved from defining the reaction coordinates to the definition of the stable states. That's what the trick that we apply. But it doesn't mean that we have solved that particular problem. We assume we can do that for the moment. And how you actually do that, that's a completely different question.
Give me an idea how you approach
it. Okay. Chemical intuition.
Energy cutoff for so many conformational.
Energy cutoff might be working for simple systems, but for protein systems, no, because the energy is actually wildly oscillating. It's all thermal. So it's much better to use conformational reaction coordinates, like, okay, there we go, like distance, RMSD, angles, dihedral angles, solvent accessible surface, also RG, radius of gyration, all these type of parameters which are defining the structure of the protein, locally or globally, can be used as an input. But the what is important is that you quickly, once you are in the so-called basin of attraction, so we have an energy landscape which might look like this here. And so if you are saying I'm only defining my stable states by this definition in some sort of a high dimensional, by this particular part of the high-dimensional space and another state by this particular part, then, of course, this is much smaller than this entire basin. And the idea of the method is that when you're actually over this barrier, that you quickly relax to this barrier. That's the assumption. And now you might say, well, okay, there's all kinds of bumps on the way. But these bumps are supposed to be happening on time scales which are much smaller than the overall time scale. So we still make this assumption that this, now let's call this the small time scale, so T small is much smaller than the T, well, let's call them large. Okay, so that's a bit of a. So, and that's actually the assumption. So you really assume that when I'm here, I'm actually able to relax to this space. If you don't do that, if you cannot do that, then you are much more in a diffusive type of regime, or you have hierarchical length scales, time scales, where you actually also have to resolve all these little things, and then you have to do different methods. I mean, this is not, the assumption is that we can actually do this. That's the assumption.
No, I find that entirely plausible, but then in a sense, you know, your bias is the definition of the basis, right?
The bias is in the definition of the base. Yes, absolutely. So that's why I'm saying at the beginning, the crucial part is this. We actually shifted all the effort to the definition of the basins. So not the definition of the user. But the idea is that when you actually are able to sample these types of paths, that you can sort of get an idea of this and then sort of iteratively improve.
I have a question to Ms. Kettle, maybe not to you, but other people here. This is always drawn like this. How good is this assumption that you have this sharp maximum?
No, you
go towards the right minimum. Isn't it much more like a very broad?
Yeah, it's more like this. It's more like this, and then absolutely. And that we can see as well.
Yeah.
But in fact, sometimes, I mean, if this is, of course, then diffusion dominates. So this, again, goes back to the question of Paul. If this is going to be diffusion dominated, then this will not, I mean, this will not work because our path will go on indefinitely. But we assume, and this is often also the case, that we do have, even if we have a diffusive landscape, there is a global driving force, a drift force towards one of those minima. And that actually happens to be, well, often true. I mean, systems like little proteins don't just run around in limbo forever. They find something and get stuck. I mean, they go to traps. All right. Okay. So this is how we sample it. And now the next step, if I do have time, I hope, because I wanted to get to this point. So what we do. Is now analyze our set of paths. I mean, we have now all these paths, so we have an idea of the kinetics, and we have an idea, and now we want to sample that. And that we do by the so-called committer analysis. And this is a well-known idea where you have a conformation X, and this is now in conformation space, so this only has the positions X. And then we start a number of trajectories with randomized velocities from the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. And then we measure how often it goes to B versus going to A. And this is what people call the committer function. And this is just a sum over all the trajectories that go to A, normalized by the total number. And this means, of course, that you can actually have an operational transition state definition where you say that PB is a half, where half of the trajectories go to B and the other half go to A. And now comes a famous statement that the PB is actually the reaction coordinate and is the only and true reaction coordinate. It just means that if I have this PB, I can exactly predict what is going on. Because if I have a PB of a 0.6, for example, I have 60% chance that I go to the final state, which is as much information that you can have on a stochastic system. So this is, and actually there are several people that actually started with Onsager, which called it a splitting probability, and Erik van der Einde actually argued in his path sampling, transition path theory that this is indeed the reaction coordinate. So what actually does it mean that this is the reaction coordinate? Because it's just a number based on a high dimensional surface. But we can now analyze our, the values of this committer, and especially the committer distribution, to test reaction coordinates. And this is a plot that that takes a little bit of explanation. So suppose that we have a free energy landscape again like this. I showed you this in the beginning. So this is the transition state. Now this is almost ideal, because if I'm restricting myself to this particular line here, I have I'm always almost on the edge, on the ridge of this free energy landscape, meaning that my PB, my committer, will be almost always half. Now, if I plot the probability of a committer, the distribution of a committer, as a function of the committer value, so this is a distribution of this this probability, and that has a peak like this, which means that it's peaked around a half. So all of these points have a committer half. Now, this is ideal. However, often you end up with this particular point, this particular surface, and if you restrict yourself to the Q star here, you can see it's either committed to A or to B, and hardly ever to anything in between, so this will look like this. So clearly, this is different from that. So you can now distinguish a bad reaction coordinate from a good one. In reality, it's also often like this. So it's all over the place. That actually is an indication that it's rather diffusive. So you have a flat landscape here on the Q value, and that will give you a thing like that. But it, even those two indicate that there are different degrees of freedom that actually should go into the description of your model until this actually is going on like that. Now, there are several ways to do that. So this is called the committer analysis. It's extremely expensive because every single PB calculation costs you a full trajectory. So that's expensive. But there are cheaper methods. I mean, especially the genetic network approach by Dinner, by Aaron Dinner, the Bayesian approach by Hummer, by Garrett Hummer, and likelihood maximization by Baron Peters and Bernard Trout, all like already quite a few years ago. So we actually opted for the likelihood maximization. Before I actually say that, is what is now the objective of our reaction coordinate? Because there's some confusion about the reaction coordinate. So it depends on the meaning and on what your objective is. I told you that the best reaction coordinate, the one and only, is the committer function. This is actually a perfect description, but it has no physical inside. It means that it's a number based on a complete configuration.
I still don't understand why you say it's... I mean, I guess we've had a discussion a number of times, but it seems to be still the argument is sort of a theological, so it's the best...
No. It's a mathematical argument saying that the PB actually predicts exactly what the reaction is going to do, and there's no improvement on it. You cannot improve on that.
What is the quantity?
This is the objective. So, the objective, if you want a perfect and optimal, the complete description, you need this. But the point is, it doesn't give you physical insight. And what we want is physical insight. So you want a low-dimensional model of it, which actually only includes a few collective variables, which gives you insight. Because that means that you can actually interpret the whole mechanism in terms of low-dimensional collective variables. This is what everyone does. If you visualize a molecular dynamics trajectory, you actually look at collective variables that are important for this transition, so things that change. That's what you do. I mean, otherwise, you won't
even bother to look at it.
So if people do an MD simulation, visualize it with VMD or something like that, and look how their molecule changes in time, that is what they actually try to do here. Now, of course, this is actually quite difficult to get a low-dimensional model of a committer. And what people actually do is saying, well, don't bother about the committer. Let's just look at the separate tricks. Just look at the dividing surface between one state and the other, and make a model of that. And that's what's being done with, for example, variational transition state theory, that where we try to optimize the dividing surface to get the best description of this particular reaction. Now, this gives you insight in the transition state, and that's also an objective that people often want. Of course, we can actually make coarser and coarser, so we can actually get any low dimensional model that describes the transition, or actually something that describes the stable states. So this is going from perfect to less perfect. And yes?
So there's another committer function. It's maybe perfect if you say I can only have one reaction coordinate, right? I mean, because it would miss if you had sort of like orthogonal variables that kind of you might wander around for a bit before going on, right?
But what do you mean? So
the committer function is just a function.
It's just a function of the whole space.
Whole space.
Yes.
It just says you're here, your probability of getting to A is X percent, and
right.
B is 9x.
So that doesn't make
sense. That does contain all the information you
can. It's all the information that you could possibly have of this system. I mean, in terms of this two-state system, of course. I mean, if you have multiple states, then you need.
What do you think will include these two paths, so to speak, which you refer?
If you are thinking of two paths, or
no. All I meant was that suppose that you know, this is. It seems to me a commuter function is sort of ideal if you kind of have like a one-dimensional slow manifold, right? So that there's everything. So. I'm saying a commuter function, it wouldn't distinguish between having a one-dimensional slow manifold and a two-dimensional slow manifold, right? If you had sort of, there was kind of the slowest transition was from here to there, but then there was also delays because of motion orthogonal to sort of the optimal path.
Well, of course it will distinguish between that. I mean, it's a complete function, as Mike just said. So, I mean, it also...
Oh, sorry.
It also... I mean, the point is, of course, that you don't get anything from it because it is so high dimensional. I mean, you have to put in this particular function here, suppose that you have 1,000 particles.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, God, okay. So you have 1,000 particles. There's 3,000 degrees of freedom in this. So it's a 3,000... dimensional system. Try to map out that. I mean, that's impossible.
Sure. And it's a projection down to from many dimensions to one dimension.
Of course, and that's the game. I mean, that's the whole game. That's what I'm saying here. In what's the objective? Here, we actually try to get a low dimensional model of it. So that's precisely the game, and we do that by. Okay, so my argument was that we want to go to here, but okay, that's it. And we do that by likelihood maximization. So what we actually obtain is, so instead of doing this committer analysis for each point, which is extremely expensive, we just use this path ensemble, which we already have. So we already have this path ensemble. And you remember that we have these shooting points, which were the instances of the Monte Carlo move. So now we can actually take these shooting points, and we can ask, what is the probability that this particular point is on a trajectory on a path that connects to state, so on a transition path. That's given by this this conditional probability, and this R here is now the reaction coordinate. So we actually project down from the high dimensional space on this low dimensional reaction coordinate, and we ask, given this reaction coordinate, what is the probability to be on a TP? And that is given by this product of the two committers, the committer to B and to A for stochastic processes. Then we can actually assume a function for this particular committer function, which is usually a smooth function, like this. It's a smooth function. And then we actually parameterize R as a linear combination of our variables. And then we do likelihood maximization, and we look for the best model in terms of these linear combinations. So these alphas are linear combination coefficients, and then we optimize this. So what does it mean? It means that if you have shooting points, right? So these, if I go back here, these shooting points here, they either go to A or they go to B. Yeah, that's the point. So here you have a separation of a cloud here. The red ones go to B, and the green ones go to A. So this is a connection of the shooting points. And they are restricted to the barrier because that's the most likely part where you do have successful trajectories. So here, so this is actually, so usually you have a whole cloud, but OK, so this is more clear. And then you can say, well, this is like the color code is a bit strange, but green is the corresponds to the open circles and red to the black circles, so the color scheme is completely screwed up. But you try to fit this binary information to a smooth function, and that actually gives you an optimized reaction coordinate. And so, for example, for the trip cage, we could actually calculate a very nice reaction coordinate profile. So here is the information of the paths themselves in red, and this is the orthogonal reaction coordinate description. So we actually calculate that for each possible combination of order parameters, and then come out with the best reaction coordinate. Okay. In view of the time, how much time do I have? I'm already way over time, I guess.
So it can go on for another 10 minutes.
Okay,
so
all right. I should, yeah, I see, I need to hurry up. So here, I mean, this is an example for this more complex system. So we did do analysis of the photoactive yellow protein, where we actually looked at an unfolding reaction, which is a pretty complex thing. So we actually established the reaction coordinates, but maybe that's a little bit too detailed. So if you have questions on this, then I can explain it to you.
So is the reaction coordinate always one-dimensional? Is that? Maybe I missed on the previous slide, but can you use this to get a sort of collective, you know, in terms of three or four variables that might be?
Yeah. So the point is, of course, of a reaction coordinate is that it is one. It should be one-dimensional because at each point it should give you the. Well, okay. So I mean, of course, it's you're right.
I mean, it's terminology, but I'm just.
It's terminology. Yeah. I mean.
It seems like what you'd like is some low-dimensional description of the system.
Yeah. So in principle, you can also, okay, maybe it's not so easy then. I mean, if you have a two-dimensional reaction coordinate, it's not so clear where you would put the dividing surface or where you put the transition state, whereas in the reaction coordinate itself, there's only one transition state. So a higher dimensional is possible, and in fact, I mean, all these projections are higher dimensional or the parameter of phase spaces, but you still want to have a description in along something that happens along a tube or a line or something like that. So when a reaction happens, it can either completely diffuse over a whole space, or it can be narrow, following narrow tubes through high dimensional space, where you where the reaction always follows one reaction pathway. So this is the tube picture, which is, for example, also used in the string method.
But depending on the question you ask, it could be that the one-dimensional description simply does not.
Yes, that's true. So there are several ways out of it. You can always so there's two viewpoints. Either you can actually say, okay, I'm going to use a higher dimensional description, but then you actually have to live with the fact that this becomes really complex. So I mean, even in two dimensions, it's already complex, as you can see here, for example. So this is the so just as an example, this is for the protein that I showed you. Here's one state, and here's another one. And in this particular order parameter space, this goes like this, back and forth in convoluted ways. So the question is, how do we? And here it's actually a more straightforward. But how do we determine which one is the best here? I mean, if you think of this as two low-dimensional pictures of the transition, you cannot just say this one is better than the other one. I mean, if you want to, then you have to do this likelihood analysis. But this was based on the fact that everything was linear and was a linear description. So we actually want to do now nonlinear description, and that is by projecting it to a string. So we actually now so this is a string description of a nonlinear process, and this is just a toy model. And now we use the same procedure, except for a nonlinear projection on this one-dimensional coordinate, and then we can actually optimize this in the best Q space that we can actually find. And this actually, for example, and I think I'm going to skip that. So one of the problems is that we do have only we have a lot of information around the settle point. We don't have information around the tails. And because everyone is now completely exhausted, I'm going to skip over that. What we do is we use the complete path ensemble, which actually includes all paths that are possible. And we use a reweighting scheme for that. So if you're interested in.
See you at the moment.
Because he's skipping the slides.
What? I'm skipping the slides.
You're skipping the slides by projecting them onto your chest.
OK. But I mean, you don't have, I mean, I didn't want you to say it. So we have a way to actually include all information from all the pathways. And if you have questions, you should come to me afterwards. So it's a reweighting scheme, and it actually works pretty nicely. And this can actually now map out a complete order of committer space and actually optimize the committer space according to these likelihoods. And so, for example, for a very simple Z potential, so these are two high barriers, there's a settle point. This is the initial path, which our initial guess of the reaction coordinate, which is obviously wrong because it crosses here. And then we, because we have all we have this reweighted path ensemble, and we can optimize this and get the best coordinate. And this is what I mean by how do we get the best coordinate in this particular space.
So the string just refers to the most likely path, is that right?
No, the string refers to the best model for the high-dimensional committer. So this is the, remember, this string has nothing to do with the physical dynamics. It is only the projection from the path ensemble. Okay, but that is so I thought I could actually pitch this all into the. Okay, so again, just to show you the idea. So this was the original idea of mapping on a linear coordinate, and now we actually are using the entire process and do it on a non-linear coordinate, and we have all the information. So that's the difference. So here we only have information about settle point, and now we have information of the true process. And I also skip this. And I think in view of the time, I want to go straight to the conclusions. So we could do this for crystal nucleation, but that has to wait for an. So we can actually do, so I just wanted to show you that we can actually now sample all unbiased complete path ensembles by reweighting, and this actually applies to any complex rare event. And we can do now the nonlinear committer analysis to find a reaction coordinate of any complex rare event. So I only showed you results for the two-state problems, but we can also expand it to any multiple-state problem that you can think of. Of course, you don't want to have thousands of states because it means you have to do thousands of pathways. But I mean, for 10, so up to 10, 20 states, this will still be efficient. So that's the, I think that's the end of the talk. I guess everyone is exhausted, so.
Okay, thank you very much.
Further questions?
You say it's efficient if you have 10 minima. I mean, quantum chemistry in terms of number of energy and gradient evaluations. So how many times do you have to evaluate
energy?
Millions of times, billions of times.
Okay, so the official answer is that it's always orders of magnitude less than if you do it brute force. That's the official answer. And in practice, yes. I mean, it's not. I mean, if you want to do this with a quantum chemist, don't forget it. This is. I'm very proud of that. We did do one complete TPS with using ab initio MD for the signaling, the proton transfer in this signaling proton, and that worked. But it was already a hell of a lot of work. We only got a few hundred paths, and each path took a week or something like that. So that in computing time, so you can imagine how expensive that is.
So a few of us were at the various occasions here during the workshop discussing what do the new computers with hundreds of thousands of processors bring and can be used for. Is that something that we can make use of, these kind of new machines, or not? By sampling many paths in parallel?
And the answer is, I think the answer is yes. It's not completely clear because what we do is a metropolis scheme, and that is a sequential scheme. That means that... Yes. But the good thing is that the decorrelation of pathways is pretty fast. So my answer would be, if I would have a good idea of, say, the multiple states that are in the system, and I have a good description of that, then I would say yes. You can very quickly get an answer for example, we can do these replica exchange events where we can have hundreds of replicas. sample on each replica, exchange them, and that will get an extremely proper, well, efficient sampling for the whole reagent. And this will be particularly suited for if you have hundreds of processors or thousands of processors.
The machines have hundreds of thousands of processors.
Yes. Okay. So there's.
That's the problem.
No, but there's two ways of dealing with this. So there is the trivial farming out of processors by doing parallel sampling, but we can also, of course, do the not so non-trivial idea of domain composition, decomposition. So we could just use, for a complex system like a protein, we can always divide it up in domain decomposition. So we can run one trajectory on 100 processors. That's trivial nowadays. So when we actually combine that with our replica scheme, so we could, for example, 100 processors for each path, we do 100 replicas, so we have 10,000 processors. Well, it's not 100,000, but then double it again, and it's already 100,000. So
different. I mean, it's the same path. You're farming out different segments of different processors.
No, of course you need different paths on each processor. So I mean.
Oh, you're saying starting them off in different places. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I mean, that's the whole idea of these multiple. So if I have multiple interfaces on each core set.
Yeah, sure.
Then each of them has a path connected to it.
Okay.
Okay, so this would be like that. And you can explore each of these paths on a single process or on a single trajectory done on 100 processes. And so, and by exchanging this, you get a pretty quick equilibration of the entire phase space. Well, I mean, by quick, I mean it's non-exponential. So it goes, yeah. So this should also, this whole method should scale with the number of interfaces, the number of interfaces you have, and with, if you want to exchange between stable states, it goes with this number of stable states squared. So it's a squared problem still. But it's always better than exponential problem. So I guess that's the, yeah. Well,
okay.
More questions?
Thanks.